Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we will be speaking with Ken Knight of the Santa Fe Men's Camerata about the tribute to four centuries of Jewish composers, and we'll be talking about the opening of the Trades and Advanced Technology Center at the Santa Fe Community College. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Diane Stanley. She's the author of the new book, The Silver Bowl, and she will be at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Glad to be here.
Now, this is a book that, what do you call it, a children's book or a young adult school? What is it?
Technically, it's what they call upper middle grade, but it can go into the what they call the young adult category. It's, you know, not because it has anything in it that's, you know, racy, but just because of the language and, you know, some of the complexity of the story.
Now, it's a story set in perhaps medieval kind of England, but we don't know exactly where it is because the names are not.
Yeah, the names are fictional, but the Westria is, you know, I think of it as England, and I made a point of giving the names of the characters to be names that could be English. Ostland is kind of like Germany, and so it becomes more Germanic.
And you start with a character who is our protagonist, a wonderful young person named Molly, who comes from just the roughest life imaginable, and at the age of 7 is essentially sold off to work in a castle for a king.
That's correct. She's very rough around the edges. She's illiterate. She talks too loud. She says the first thing that comes into her head. She has no manners. But she's just full of fire and determination and bravery and humor, and she's just a really, really fun character to write because she just goes off on her own tangent.
And she's the kind of character who, I must say, is really compelling for girls to read. When this is the type of book that I sought out just as much as I possibly could when I was in fifth, sixth grade, you know, around that age. And I think there is something about when you are a little kid who basically is, you've got to be good, reading about a girl who doesn't have to be good or who is dealing with the edges of that stuff is very satisfying.
Yeah, well, I've written a number of books that have female characters. They're always strong, but Molly is a little more rough around the edges than anybody I've ever written about before, and I really kind of enjoyed that. I mean, I sort of got in touch with my sort of inner wild child when I was writing it.
Now, she is somebody who is a kind of a visionary. She has premonitions. She sees things that later come true, and in fact that come true very quickly, and that is considered to be something a little scary and possibly a great handicap, but that sets the stage for the story and all the things that happen.
Yeah, her grandfather had, which I explore at great depth in the second book.
Yes, this is the first of a trilogy.
First of a trilogy, and you know, she gets a handle on her gift, her magical gift. She inherited it from her grandfather through her mother, and it's really a burden to her because it's frightening, and she sees things either that happen in the distant past or that will happen in the future, and many of them are horrible, and she's supposed to do something about it, and she doesn't know what. And, you know, for a young girl, that's pretty frightening. Yeah, so she actually has tremendous magical powers. She just hasn't learned what they are or how to use them yet.
And she has to make sure that other people don't find out, because that's a time and a place where you could be branded as a witch and
absolutely
terrible,
yeah,
things will happen to you.
You know, her mother, actually, as you learn in the first chapter, has been kept locked up for much of Molly's life because the father says she's mad. And she's not. She just has these visions.
Now, the Silver Bowl is a magical bowl, which is, we don't want to give away too much of the book, but it's a bowl that has been infused with certain powers, and this girl discovers it and has a kind of a communication with this bull. There is a real bull that was the inspiration that got you going on this whole story.
Well, actually, it was originally going to be a Chinese porcelain bull. I saw one when I was on a speaking trip in China. And, you know, I mean, I'd seen them before, but I saw this at a shrine sale. And all of a sudden it came into my head that, you know, all these little figures that are painted on the bull could actually move. You know, they could tell the story of the life of the boy who, you know, who had it and so forth. And I got all these books and I did all this research to write this Chinese story. And I came to the conclusion, I always do a lot of research for everything I do, including fiction. And I didn't feel that I could ever know enough about Chinese culture to do that book to my satisfaction.
Your level of standard.
Yeah. So I decided to move it to a time and place that I was familiar with, and I had written and researched 5 biographies of characters that lived in the, you know, the High Middle Ages and the Renaissance. And so I really knew it quite well, but I still did more research for it to just spark ideas. And this whole custom of washing the hands in a royal hall or any nobleman's hall, where they brought out the basin and they have the ewer and they pour the water and they, you know, it takes 3 servants to wash your hands. And because you ate with your hands in those days, you know, you washed your hands between each course and so forth. So that seemed to be something that would be a great ceremonial piece. And that's, of course, what the curses are in that she has to deal with.
I have to say, I really appreciate the fact that you got to a point with writing the Chinese story where you said, I can't do this justice. There's a kind of humility and truth about that, that not everybody will hold themselves to that standard.
Yeah. Well, I really try. I'm telling a story. You know, I want my characters to be, you know, breathing characters that you relate to, and I want the story to be exciting and interesting. But the background is important, too. And I really try in my books to give a sense of the attitudes and the beliefs and the customs and the way people lived at that particular time. And there are a lot of words in there that'll be new to pretty much anyone who reads it.
What are some examples of that?
Just a slight example. It's not so much a word, but a phrase that Tobias, who is Molly's friend, is introduced as the donkey boy. And a donkey boy is someone who, you know, a servant who does the donkey work.
Instead of the donkey.
Yeah, he
carries
is the donkey.
Stuff around.
He
yeah.
is the donkey. He brings in the firewood and so forth. And, you know, I found it in a book. And a lot of the details of how the royalty and the poor people lived and how they interacted and, you know, all of that is stuff I did research on. And I couldn't have done that in China.
Right, exactly. And I got such a sense, I was thinking while I was reading the book, and it is such a gripping read. I love that it just takes you in on the first page and does not let you out until you reach the last page. It's very, very satisfying. Mm. There's a sense of realism to this. It felt so authentic to me, and I thought, how do I know what's authentic in the Middle Ages? And I realized that I have my frame of reference is really kind of movies about the period.
Except that movies usually get it wrong, and that's why it sort of spoiled me for anything American. The Brits do it right.
But, right. Yeah. So this, I think one of the things that's so satisfying about this book for me as an adult is, first of all, it reminded me of the kinds of books that I devoured when I was a child, but also that, I mean, I guess, and the reason for that was this sense of magic all around, this sense of the, you know, your long gone grandfather or great grandfather, whatever, reappearing in some ways, and the continuities among generations that happen in this really magical way. There's something about that that stimulates the imagination in a way that feels like we need this.
I think we do. And I, you know, I write the books that I would have wanted to read as a child. And, you know, you're really not that different as an adult. You know, you've just grown up and you know more, but you're emotionally, you still sort of seek. When I read a book, I want to go somewhere I've never been before. And so I don't tend to be drawn to books about unhappy housewives. Or, you know, you know what I'm saying? I want to sort of imagine something that I've never thought of before, and to learn something. I mean, we learn about silver polishing in my second book. I'm working on it now, so that's where my head is. But one of the major characters is a rat catcher, and you learn all about rat catching, and it's so fun to do that. One of the point of view characters is a raven. I mean, it's fun to play with that kind of magic in
now,
writing.
When you write a book like this, when you write a character like Molly and then all of the people around her and the princes and princesses and other servants and abbots and so on, what is the process like? I mean, so many writers talk about this process of the book taking on a life of its own. Does it do that for you?
Oh, absolutely. I have tried. I keep thinking it'll be more efficient and I'll write it more quickly and it'll be tighter and better if I do an outline and a character study. And I've done it about 3 times and I might as well throw them away because I write things and then once I get going, it doesn't work or that's not who this character is. And often I don't discover quite who a character is till I've finished the book. And then I have to go back. I mean, I go back and back and back. I must do, 10 revisions before I even send it to my editor and then more revisions after that. Because it's a thought process. You write your way into knowing who these characters are and what your story is. And it can completely change.
Yeah, well, it always occurs to me that there's like a plant metaphor hidden there, which is like you, the author, discover a seed, you plant it, and then it grows the way it's going to grow. Yeah. And the more attention and water and fertilizer you give it, the more it grows into what it is, not what you want it to be.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of it comes out of your subconscious. I mean, things just appear, on the page, and you think, where did that come from? And then sometimes you look back on it 2 years later and say, oh, of course. It's obvious where that came from.
So there was a... You set something in motion early, but you didn't even know later what the purpose of that thing was.
Yeah, sometimes.
So we're talking about the book The Silver Bull by Diane Stanley, who's going to be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow in the evening, at 6:00 in the evening. So did you conceive of this as a trilogy in the first place?
No. I thought of it as a standalone book. And at the end, by the time I finished it, I knew that this story had just begun. I knew that she needed to develop and understand her powers and, get in touch with her past and her grandfather and all of that. I knew her relationship with Tobias and with the prince needed to be developed. And once I started thinking about it on those lines, it just all fell into place. And, there is, book 2 is about something in particular and book 3 resolves everything. And it's thrilling to not start over with new characters, but to, it's like sitting down and meeting a new person can be exciting, but sitting down with your best friend,
And getting to see people grow over the years.
Yeah,
and
I mean, you know them and you share things and you have a past experiences, and that's the way I feel about these characters. I mean, they get to keep growing and changing and evolving.
There are some books, I read the book and loved the book Anne of Green Gables
when I was a little kid. Favorite, yes,
and
absolutely.
I never finished the series because it just goes on and on and on.
I didn't either.
She turns old, but she's at the beginning, she's a girl with flaming red hair and a tremendous temper, and she gets adopted by a family that just doesn't know what to do with this wild child, but she's lovely. And then in the next books, she's sort of tamed, and she gets into a love story, which when you're in the sixth grade is just infinitely boring.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about Molly. Does Molly get tamed, or does she
retain? Okay,
good.
No, she does not get tamed. She gets stronger with each book. And by the end, it's going to be very dramatic. What happens to this trio of people and their relationships, and there's going to be a big surprise.
Now, do you already know?
I know. I mean, it came to me sort of towards the end of writing the second book, what had to happen. And then once I knew that, everything all became clear.
Now, when you you've just published this book. It's a HarperCollins book. Presumably it'll have quite a wide readership, we hope. Have you gotten any feedback yet from young people?
I've gotten not from young people. It was only published a few days ago.
Okay.
But I have gotten two reviews, both of them starred reviews, from Kirkus and from Booklist. Very, very nice reviews. And two starred reviews is a great start for a book. So
what happens then when you have a young people's book? Do you then have to, or does the publisher then have to make sure it gets into all the school libraries and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, they have marketing both for bookstores and for the school and library market. I just came back from Texas Library Association meeting where I, gave a speech. And, so you're out there meeting the school librarians. And that's, that's part of what we do. We travel around and we speak at schools. And
Does a book like this, do you expect it to be read more by girls?
Probably. Girls actually read more than boys do, sadly. But I think it's something that, two of the main characters are boys, so it's not just a girl's book, but the main character is a girl.
No, I know. Yeah. I'm trying to remember back, because when I was young, I was in a kind of a little group of girls who really read, and we exchanged books among ourselves, and there were no boys in our group at all.
Yeah.
But there were boy readers, and I don't know if they were reading the same things that we were.
I don't know the answer to that either. I know my son was certainly an avid reader, and he read everything. I mean, and still does.
Not just Superboy.
Oh no, no,
war
no, no.
stories. Or
but he loved, The Lion and Witch in the Wardrobe.
Right.
He loved. There was a sort of a watered down version of the Odyssey that he read over and over again. I mean, so a little the fantasy element, some science fiction, but he read everything. I mean, he had very. I think truly more girls do read than boys.
The book is called The Silver Bull by Diane Stanley, and once again, she will be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow evening, Thursday at 6 o'clock. Anything you want to add before we go?
Just one thing. The writing process, and we were talking about this earlier, the writing process is just so pleasurable. I mean, you go in your room and you sit down there in this little world with these characters, and I would like to think that some young people would look upon it, take the second step from isn't it wonderful to to read these books and travel into some world you've never been before, but then you can create your own, and
well, this is the thing. I mean, when I was young, I would read these books, just devour them, and then I would walk down the little lane to the bus stop in the morning, hoping so much that I would get swallowed up into a different time dimension through finding a magic amulet on the ground, and it never happened. And
yeah.
I, landed at the bus stop and had to face the kind of Lord of the Flies school.
Well, this sort of is the magic amulet.
Yeah.
To be able to do work at a creative job, and Santa Fe is full of people who do it, and that's one of the things I like about Santa Fe. But it is magical to be. You can make your own magic, and I would like to think that from reading, a lot of kids would sort of take that second step.
And what does that second step look like?
That second step looks like writing a little newspaper for your neighborhood and making up reviews of books that don't exist and writing about things that never happened and drawing pictures of them and trying to write a novel set in the French Revolution, even though you don't know anything about the, that's what I did as a kid. I wrote a play in which all of the characters were dead by the end.
Oh my God.
And I still have it. It's just, it's hilarious. But, I felt the need to write. And I think there probably are kids out there. They're the ones who read. They also want to write. And, I encourage them to do it.
Are kids still reading books? I mean, are the school libraries active centers? Have their attention spans been really taken away, as we hear in the media? I don't know to what extent it's really true, by video games and cell phones and all TV and computers and all that stuff.
To some extent, I think they, of course, they're distracted by all that and all of their sort of scheduled activities as well, you know, the sports and the dance and, you know, karate or whatever they do. But actually, the statistics show that the greatest growing readership in the United States is in young people. And they are reading, and book clubs are popping up in schools. And the libraries, yes, are hugely important. And it breaks my heart when, you know, they cut the funding for them because, you know, there's this idea that all you do in a library is check out books, and that is so not true. They are such a force for getting kids involved in books and learning and activities that are very important to kids. So, yes, that's where the book clubs are, for example.
Right, right. Diane Stanley, The Silver Bowl, once again, Collected Works Bookstore, Thursday evening, tomorrow evening at 6. Thanks so much for being with us
in
the Radio
Cafe.
Thank you,
Marisha. I enjoyed it.
We're going to take a break and be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome to the program Ken Knight. He is the director of the Santa Fe Men's Camerata, which is doing a performance this Saturday and Sunday at Temple Beth Shalom. It's a tribute to 4 centuries of Jewish composers. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to see you and chat with you.
Now, 4 centuries of Jewish composers. Are we talking about music that is religious music in some way, or just that the composers themselves are Jewish, some of both?
Both. The pieces on the first half of the program are mostly liturgical pieces, beginning with a wonderful piece by 16th century composer Salomone Rossi, who was inspired by Palestrina and Victoria and wrote very much in their style. And then there's some other liturgical pieces by contemporary composers. There's a Ladino folk song. There is a medley from Fiddler on the Roof. And then there's the second half of the concert is almost entirely music by popular composers, Irving Berlin, Jerome Kern, Richard Rodgers, Fritz Lowe, Stephen Sondheim, the whole panoply of great American songwriters, most of whom were Jewish.
Let's go back to the 16th century, for example, 16th, 17th century. Was there musical cross-pollination between Jewish and Christian music?
Very much so, yeah, exactly. The piece we're doing by Mr. Rossi was inspired by the prevailing style of cathedral music in Italy. He was trained in Italy.
And so these are choral pieces that if you didn't know what they were saying, you might think that they were Christian music?
Exactly. Uh-huh, yeah.
Very interesting. What were Jewish religious services like at that time?
I have no idea, but I'm sure there are historians who do.
Right.
But no, there was a lot of cross-pollination in musical styles in that day and age.
Now, Ladino folk music, mm-hmm. What does the word Ladino mean?
It's a language based on Spanish. It's really a dialect of antique, very formal, high Spanish, but heavily influenced by languages in the countries to which the Jews moved when they were expelled from Spain by Ferdinand and Isabella in 1492. A lot of them ended up in Greece, so Ladino from that region of the world has a lot of Greek words in it. A lot of them ended up in the Balkans, so there are a lot of Serbo-Croatian Yugoslav sort of words in their language. Some of them, as you probably know, ended up in northern New Mexico.
Right.
And but it's basically a Spanish-based language with lots of Hebrew as well mixed in with it, and then the languages from the places where Jews immigrated to when they were expelled from Spain.
Now, if you speak Hebrew or if you speak Spanish, can you understand Ladino?
You could probably understand Ladino if you spoke Spanish, yes.
So it's kind of like if you speak German, you can understand a lot of Yiddish.
A lot of Yiddish, exactly. Exactly.
And what is the nature of the Ladino folk music tradition?
This particular song that we're doing is sounds very Spanish, almost flamenco, and yet it has that typical sort of Middle Eastern Jewish set of intervals. Da 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 da. That particular collection of intervals, which sounds very Middle Eastern to us, and this particular folk song was arranged by Michael Isaacson, who is a living contemporary American composer.
Now, some of the music that you're doing is sung by cantors.
Yes, the cantor tradition in synagogue is of course ancient and venerable, and continues to this day. Cantors at one time were men only, of course, but these days lots of sopranos and mezzo-sopranos are serving as cantors in Reform synagogues.
What is the role of the cantor in a synagogue?
To lead the singing and to embellish the choral pieces with solos, including some improvisatory phrases. And he's basically a soloist who's kind of backed up by a choir.
I didn't grow up going to church a whole lot, but I have gone to church enough times to know that when you sing along with a hymn from the hymnals that are in front of you on the little rack, and that the, they're really kind of easy. And I guess they're easy so that the people who are not trained singers in the chorus can kind of follow along, and it's not a total mess.
Yeah.
But when you have a cantor who's singing, who is really a professional singer, you're adding kind of a dimension of almost, I don't know what you want to call it, professionalism or sophistication to the music.
Yes, and much of the cantorial tradition is very operatic in nature, so the music tends to be a great deal more sophisticated and more difficult when the cantor is singing a solo. It's not at all hymn-like. Now, the cantor does occasionally lead the congregation in singing prayers that are more like hymns. By the way, the Catholic Church had cantors many centuries ago, and then the practice died out, and then was revived after Vatican II, when congregational singing became the norm again. And so cantors in Catholic churches, their primary function is to lead the congregation in singing, not so much to do solos.
We're talking to Ken Knight, and the Santa Fe Men's Camerata is doing a tribute to four centuries of Jewish composers at Temple Beth Shalom this Saturday and Sunday, Saturday at 7 o'clock and Sunday at 4 o'clock. Now,
correct.
The second half of the show, it looks like basically mostly show tunes, with a few exceptions.
It's show tunes and popular songs. The first piece by Irving Berlin is Give Me Your Tired, Your Poor, which a poem by Emma Lazarus, which is inscribed in bronze and mounted on the wall at the Statue of Liberty. It's the only text by another person that Irving Berlin ever set. All of his other songs, and there were probably 1,500 that he wrote in his lifetime, were all to his own lyrics. This is the only one that uses someone else's lyrics.
And when you think about the sentiment of that, give us your tired, your poor, that's sort of not the era that we're living in today.
Well, it very much reflects, of course, the wave upon wave of immigration that came through New York Harbor and Ellis Island and passed under the Statue of Liberty.
Exactly. But that sentiment of welcoming and abundance and what we can give is something to kind of think about and remember.
It is, yeah.
And some of the other people, as you said, George Gershwin and Richard Rodgers and Frederick Lowe and Stephen Sondheim, what are those like for you as the conductor, as the director of the Men's Camerata, to teach and to lead your group? I mean, is this fun, easy stuff? Is it incredibly difficult?
It's great fun. It's not especially difficult. And for a group of American male singers, it's a lot easier to teach them that repertoire than it is the liturgical stuff in foreign languages that they, most of them, do not speak.
Right.
I can't tell you how much more time-consuming it is to teach a difficult four-part piece to men that's in Hebrew or Yiddish or Ladino. And because all of these composers of the popular songs are Americans, that repertoire is just a part of our heritage. People have heard it all their lives, and they have a great deal more affinity for it.
Yeah, it comes naturally to
sing. The style
comes
naturally to them, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, much easier to teach.
Tell us more about the Men's Camerata. This is a group of singers, some of whom have probably been professional singers at some time in their lives. Is
very
that right?
Very few. Very few. Only a couple. Most of them are just guys that like to sing. And some are fairly well trained as singers, and some aren't. Some read music fairly well. Some don't. At one time, we had a much wider age span. We had some high school kids, a couple of college kids, and then men up into their early 80s. The high school kids have all gone off to seek their fortune in the world, and our group is getting older and older.
But, and there's not a new crop of high school kids coming to take their place?
You know, I wish there were, but... singing, particularly this style of music and this particular repertoire, just doesn't seem cool to kids much anymore these days. So it's really hard to find young people who want to hang out with us old guys and sing this type of music.
Nerdy singer kids, take note. You will have fun.
You will. You will have a lot of fun.
I mean, there's something just simply about getting together with people and singing, which is... like nothing else.
Exactly. And there's nothing like the sound of a good men's chorus. It's a sonority that's just like nothing else on earth. It's just can be utterly thrilling. It's almost always beautiful, and just a profound experience singing in a men's chorus.
Having said that, some of the pieces in this concert, the tribute to four centuries of Jewish composers, do call for mixed choruses, and you've got some women from your other choruses who are joining in.
That's right. Some women from the Canticum Novum Chamber Chorus and my Zia singers are joining us on two of the liturgical pieces, Shalom Rav, a song about peace in the world by Ben Steinberg, and then the second movement of Leonard Bernstein's Chichester Psalms. It's a sort of conversation between the men and the women. The women sing a beautiful, serene, lyrical setting of the 23rd Psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd." The men come barreling in and interrupt them with a loud, raucous setting of the Psalm, I think it's Psalm 2, "Why do the heathen so furiously rage together? Why do the people imagine a vain thing?" And they carry on and a very blustery fashion for several pages, and then the serene Psalm 23 comes back with the women's voices again, and they kind of overlap. The score is marked when the women come in the second time with the tune of the 23rd Psalm. In parentheses above the women's parts, it says, "blissfully unaware of threat," as the men are growling and grumbling along underneath them.
Good heavens.
Yeah. Bernstein had a sense of humor.
Yes, indeed. So any other favorites from this concert that you'd like to point out to people?
Well, the last two pieces are very much a part of the baby boomers' heritage, "Blowin' in the Wind" by Bob Dylan, and "Bridge Over Troubled Water" by Paul Simon. Gorgeous arrangement of "Bridge Over Troubled Water." So those will be very familiar to most of the audience, and in fact, I wouldn't even mind if people sing along.
Ah, okay.
On those, yeah.
Do people do that in your concerts from time to time?
They do, from time to time. I'm actually expecting most of the folks from the Temple Beth Shalom congregation who are coming to the concert to sing along in the two songs that we're doing that were used in the movie Schindler's List. One is Oifen Pripachuk. It's a song about the rabbi teaching the children the alphabet by the hearth, by the fireside. And most people think it's a folk song. It's so well known, particularly all across Eastern Europe, and has been known for over 100 years. But in fact, it was composed by a guy named Markovich Warszawski, who was a friend of what's the guy who wrote the book on which Fiddler on the Roof is based, Shalom Aleichem. Shalom Aleichem. He was a friend of his. And Aleichem said to him, listen, why don't you publish these things? Warshawski just had never notated them or written them down. He just sang them from memory, accompanying himself on the piano. And Aleichem said, why don't you write these things down? They're fabulous. And you know, if I didn't know that you had personally written Oifen Pripachuk, I would swear that my mother taught this to me her knee. It's so folk-like, melodious and so singable. And I'll bet you most people in the congregation will know that song. And I bet a lot of them will also know the other song from Schindler's List, which is, they call it the second Israeli national anthem. It's a song by Naomi Shemer. It was written just about the time of the Six Days War in the late 60s. Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. And it was such a hit in Israel that it became so well known that everybody learned to sing it, and it's sung at many civic occasions, and people know it almost as well as they do the national anthem.
Which you are also singing in this concert. You're starting off with that.
We're starting off with the Israeli national anthem, which is also thought of often as a folk song, or something that just kind of arose spontaneously from the earth, but in fact was composed by a fellow named Samuel Cohen. It's based on a Romanian folk song. The composer Smetana used the same Romanian folk song as the main theme for his tone poem, The Moldau.
Oh, okay.
You know that great big
tune?
Da da dee da da dum da dum da dum da da. Well, it's the same tune, except in a different meter.
Right.
That Cohen converted into the Israeli national anthem.
The event is tribute to four centuries of Jewish composers, the Santa Fe Men's Camerata, led by Ken Knight, who it's just great to have you back on the program.
Thank you.
Temple Beth Shalom this Saturday at 7 in the evening and Sunday at 4 in the afternoon. Well, thanks for being with us, and we'll see you there.
Very good. Thank you.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm happy now to welcome to the program Randy Grissom. He is the Dean of Economic and Workforce Development at Santa Fe Community College and is here to tell us about the opening of the Trades and Advanced Technology Center, which is this coming Friday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon at the community college. Welcome.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Good morning.
Good morning. So this is a whole new gigantic building.
Correct. We have a building that we actually moved into earlier this semester, had a soft opening, and it is designed to offer trades and advanced technology programs with a focus on sustainable technologies.
And so it's basically something that houses classrooms and laboratories?
Correct. We have four standard classrooms, a little more than standard. They got really nice features in them. And then we have six versatile workshops that are all two stories tall with big roll-up outdoor doors, so we can bring big equipment in or vehicles in if we need to. And we have six of those. And they are dedicated, right now, we have one dedicated to our biofuels program, one that's dedicated to our solar energy and engineering and electronics program, one that's being used for plumbing, one for heating, ventilation, and air conditioning, and one is our New Mexico Energy Smart Academy, which is a weatherization and energy auditor and OSHA training center.
So all of this both prepares people to participate in the new renewable technologies, and it promotes those technologies.
It does those, and it provides the training and the basic trades that you need to be in those technologies, too. So, you know, to get a job to make the most money as a solar photovoltaic installer, if you're a licensed electrician, you move to the front of the line for a job and make more money. Same thing is true as a licensed plumber for solar thermal. So we have the basic trades, we have the sustainable green technology trades, and then we got the advanced technologies such as engineering and electronics.
How far can you go with engineering and electronics at the community college?
Well, we offer two-year degrees, associate degrees. We have transfer degrees, associate of science degrees, and then we have job-oriented degrees that are associate of applied science degrees, and then we have certificate programs. So most of the certificate programs, you focus really in just on the major, and you can complete those in two semesters or three semesters if you're going full-time. And then the two-year degrees, it takes two full years, usually a summer involved. If you're thinking of transferring to four-year university, then through the advising process, we work with you, and we recommend the Associate of Science or Associate of Arts degree because you take more general studies and less in your major because the university wants you to take that when you get there.
So what's interesting about this, you build a technology center for a technology that is changing very rapidly. So you have to not only kind of plan for the future, but plan for an unknown future.
Absolutely. One of the things that we did in designing this building, we had groups of people who went around and talked with other schools, other community colleges, asked what they would do differently, and we've made our workshops as flexible as they can be, so we can easily change the technology in them or even change it during the middle of a semester if we needed to. You know, a lot of what we're doing is changes a little bit every semester because the technology is changing on us, so we got to stay ahead of the game.
What are some of the kind of exciting and interesting things that young people are doing in the classes at the community college right now? I mean, you've got rainwater catchment, you've got all kinds of solar thermal roof panels. There's stuff that I think a lot of us kind of wish we had in our own houses. We kind of haven't caught up, but we just observe it from afar.
Right. Well, one of the things that I'm really excited about this open house on Friday and hope the public will come out and see is the building itself is a symbol of sustainability and has a lot of features that not only are sustainable in themselves, but are part of the classroom experience and part of the educational process for the students and for the public in general. So we're trying to demonstrate how you can use rainwater catchment and snowmelt catchment and use that water to flush toilets.
So you have that going in
the center. We have that going in the building. How you can use new building materials that are greener. We've exposed.
What are some of those?
Well, we have ICF, which I'm going to forget. We've actually poured concrete on site. It has insulation right in the middle of the bricks. The whole building was kind of built as a modular building. We do have solar thermal panels on the roof, and that is being used to air condition and heat the building. So we're one of the few buildings in this country that uses an adsorber to pull the heat out. It's a heat exchanger so that we can actually air condition the building using solar energy.
How does that work?
Well, it's sort of a magic process. This adsorber actually is a heat exchanger, so it pulls the heat out of the hot water and turns it cool, and then we heat and cool our buildings we have cold water and hot water loops that are running around, and we have periodically have fans. We don't have radiant heat. So we're demonstrating that, and that machine happens to be in our plumbing lab. So
very interesting. I mean, the old community college, I remember when I started at the radio station, I've been here for 10 years, it used to rain right into the control room. That's how well insulated the roof was.
Right. This building is very well insulated. You know, we moved in January when the single-digit temperatures, our heaters really weren't working at the time, but with the orientation of the building, south-facing windows, heat coming in, we have passive solar on some of our workshops. Those rooms stayed warm.
It's interesting. I have been noticing that there's kind of a bit of a divide in the people who are promoting renewable energy. Some people are just basically building everything the same but putting solar technology on. And others are saying, let's use even the least amount of solar energy, active solar energy necessary by having south-facing windows and things like that. And there are people who've built their houses to be essentially kind of vehicles that move air around for warming and cooling without a whole lot of help from machines.
Absolutely. You know, in a lot of ways, and of course the climate depends where you live, depends upon what you can do, but in a lot of ways we're going back to the Santa Fe of 100 and 200 years ago. South-facing walls, thick walls to mass to provide insulation, you know, green roofs. We have a green roof in our building too. So we're demonstrating, you know, how we can use plant materials to provide insulation. You know, we are doing active solar, but we're also doing passive solar.
So all of these things are part of the Santa Fe Community College's Trade and Advanced Technology Center. Now, itself is a LEED certified building?
Right now we're LEED registered. We haven't finished the LEED process. We're fairly comfortable we'll end up being LEED Platinum.
Is it the highest one?
The highest is actually we're going to be LEED Gold, excuse me. LEED Platinum is the highest. We had to cut a couple things out from our budget. But we also have a welding workshop that we will eventually offer, and that uses a lot of electricity. So there's no way we could generate everything we need when we have all our programs going.
You also have a rooftop garden.
We have a small rooftop garden. It's we've planted some things up there in the dead of winter, so we'll be interested to see if we have to replant now that spring and summer are coming on board.
Spring and summer with their attendant snows and
yes.
frosts and freezes.
Yes, and amazingly to me, I don't know how it happened, but tumbleweeds ended up on the second floor and the third floor of the building. So
tumbleweeds tumbled
all the way
anti-gravity
up.
Wise up to the roof.
They bounced or climbed the wall. I'm not sure which.
We're talking to Randy Grissom, who's the dean of the Economic and Workforce Development Center at the Santa Fe Community College. Now, do you have a lot of students signing up for these programs?
We do. We have about 300 students right now enrolled in our programs. With our new building, we could easily double that or go further because we have the space now to do it. One of the things that, you know, Santa Fe Community College never really had the trades programs before, and we didn't have the space to do something. And so now with this new building, this is meeting the vision of both our president, Dr. Artigo, and the needs of the community. We have a lot more space to do the hands-on training, which you've got to do in these programs. So even with the classrooms we have and the labs that where we do the hands-on, we think we can easily accommodate 600 to 900 students per semester in that building.
Let's say you get to that goal. Are there jobs waiting for them?
There are. You know, even in this tough economic time, I'm really surprised at some of the placements we're getting. You know, everybody's looking for good employees, well-trained employees. We've got people coming back who already have bachelor's and master's degrees, now learning a new skill, a new trade area. So, you know, they're moving out there and they're getting jobs.
And if you were to look forward, let's say 5, 10, 15 years, and you saw the kind of public policy that supported more of these jobs and more of this kind of technology, what would that look like? I mean, what do you see as a really green energy supporting type of public policy?
Well, you know, I think some of the things that we do have in place that I hope will stay in place, some of the tax credits for installing renewable energy systems will help. I think the new green building codes in the city of Santa Fe and that Santa Fe County are looking for are going to help. The home building industry will come back. We're not sure exactly when, but it will come back. And so we're going to build homes to be better, more sustainable, to use less energy, to, you know, to take advantage of natural things like south-facing, but also to use renewable energy and use a lot of weatherization features. I mean, you can actually save a lot of money just by weatherizing and using the right insulation materials.
Does the home building industry, I mean, has it caught up with this vision of the future?
In Santa Fe, I believe they have. You know, the Green Building Code here was heavily developed with the input from the Santa Fe Area Home Builders Association. We work very closely with them and their Green Building Council. They help us, develop our curriculum, even teach some of our classes. So we're actually, most of our classes right now are taught by people who work in the field already, run their own businesses. They're potential employers.
And when you say in Santa Fe, we're getting there, what about the rest of the state?
Well, I think that's slowly getting there. I think Santa Fe in this area is certainly more progressive than the rest of the state. I think one of the things that's important is when we talked about sustainability in the past, we mostly talked about it in terms of environmental issues and, you know, how can we help the environment. But when you really look at it, there's a bottom line, positive bottom line impact for businesses and individuals and their homeowners to use these new technologies and to go back and use some of the old technologies that have been updated.
Randy Grissom is Dean of Economic and Workforce Development at Santa Fe Community College. And once again, the grand opening celebration of the Trades and Advanced Technology Center is this Friday at 2 o'clock. And people can wander around, look at the open house, ask questions, meet Randy Grissom. And
even better than that, they can come meet our faculty and students. We have students, our solar club, our biofuels club. They're going to be doing demonstrations, doing projects, installing solar panels, producing biofuel from waste grease and waste products like old donuts. And
old donuts. Well, thanks for being with us in the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.